This is a podcast from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Welcome to Health and Living with me, T. Xiaoyik. This is NCD Chronicles, a series where we go beyond the disease diagnosis to look at the lived experiences and real challenges faced by people who have non-communicable diseases. Chronic kidney disease, especially end-stage renal disease, is an NCD that is placing a tremendous burden on our healthcare system because of the growing number of people who require dialysis. It's an NCD that many Malaysians are likely familiar with, but are we truly aware about what these individuals have to go through for the rest of their lives? Today, we'll be speaking to Siva Kumar Raghavan, an entrepreneur in the early childhood education business. Siva is turning 52 this year, and in his case, his chronic kidney disease did progress to end-stage renal disease since he was first diagnosed 14 years ago.
Well, I was diagnosed with chronic kidney disease in 2008 when I was just 38 years old, 14 years already now. I've gone through all phases, actually. I was a chronic kidney disease patient, and then I started on peritoneal dialysis and then transplant for four and a half years and then hemodialysis now.
For Siva, he was glad that he took the cues from his body that something was not right, as well as the advice from his circle of friends that it was worth investigating further.
So I was working and I went to have my breakfast. After having the breakfast, I was walking back to office and I was feeling a little giddy, right? I was a little surprised because up to that age, I've never felt sick. The major sickness, having flu, fever, that's normal. So I was feeling giddy, slightly, feeling not right. So I went back to the office and told my senior, and then I said, I think I'm not well. And he suggested me to go to the doctor. And I went and I checked. I was surprised to know that I had hypertension. But he told me that, Siva, I'm not going to prescribe you with any hypertensive medication. Let's observe this for another few more days, probably a week or so. And then we see. Because I am a very active person in terms of even at work, I do 7 days a week. I travel all around Southeast Asia. So lots of traveling. I even like Penang or Johor, I'll just drive in the morning and do my road shows and come back in the evening. So that was the kind of life I was living. So due to that, he thought it was work stress and that's why the hypertension. So we observed that for a week or so. And then he said, Siva, I think you are having hypertension. So yeah, I took the hypertensive medication. He said, anyhow, we have to observe again. So went back there after a week. He realized that the hypertension is the same. So he suspected something else is wrong. So he suggested that I have to do full blood test. So I was already in Rotary at that time, with Rotary Club of Malawati. One of my Rotarian, he has a pathology lab. Yeah. So he suggested me to do the full blood test. And after that, that same evening, he called me to tell that, Siva, I have to tell you that there is some signs of your kidney has affected because the creatinine was slightly high and the urea was slightly high. That was the very early stage of kidney deteriorating. So then he referred me to Hospital Kuala Lumpur because he said that would be the best for you. And in a short period of time, they did biopsy, MRI, ultrasound. All the tests were taken and they realized that it was due to my immune system attacking my organ, which is called immunoglobulin nephritis A. that was my initial stage of me knowing my kidney failure.
Siva was diagnosed with immunoglobulin A nephropathy, a disease that occurs when the antibody called immunoglobulin A, which usually forms a vital part of our immune system, builds up in the kidneys. Over time, it can affect the kidney's ability to filter out waste from your blood and eventually result in kidney damage. According to Dr. Rosnawati Yahya, a consultant nephrologist from Hospital Kuala Lumpur, it's a condition that we are seeing more of.
IgA nephropathy is not considered a very common condition, but certainly one of those that we see in many patients leading to end-stage renal disease. The incidence is definitely increasing, and based on the Malaysian Registry of Renal Biopsy Report 2020, the incidence of IgA nephropathy has certainly gone up from about 17% of all biopsies performed in the country back in 2005 to 2009, and this figure has increased to 27% in the last 5 years. So it looks like we are now biopsying more and more patients with IgA nephropathy. I think with the screening program, with a better screening program where we can actually detect this disease at earlier stages where the patients are generally asymptomatic, because that's one of the clinical presentation of IgA nephropathy. Their patients are asymptomatic and they will be detected to have blood and protein in the urine. And I think CKD awareness is increasing, so the general practitioner or primary care doctors will refer this patient to nephrology so that they can get a kidney biopsy.
As with many common NCDs, the management of it can be challenging for patients because it ultimately boils down to making behavioral changes. For people living with chronic kidney disease, they can't reverse the damage that's done to the kidney, but they can slow it down and put off needing dialysis for as long as possible. So whether someone has chronic kidney disease due to IgA nephropathy like Siva, or more commonly due to diabetes or hypertension like many others, they will need to make the switch from a more sedentary lifestyle to an active, healthier one.
I think the most struggling situation for the patients in terms of CKD progression is actually getting themselves into a healthy lifestyle. Our patients generally eat a lot of food that leads to obesity, such as lots of carbohydrate, lots of sugars in the drinks. And many Malaysians are not practicing healthy lifestyle, exercising. If you look at the KDGO, Kidney Disease Global Outcome Guidelines, one of the most important contributions to retardation of CKD program is actually maintaining healthy body weight, low salt diet, and exercise at least 150 minutes a week. Based on what you can do, you need to increase the intensity of exercise. And in my experience, if I sit in a clinic and I ask a patient, how much do you exercise in a week? They don't do it. They don't do it. They come to the clinic, increasing their weight, so on and so forth. They always say they have no time. So because they leave for work at 7, they come home by 7 p.m., they will exercise at weekend, but that's about it. I think employers need to look at encouraging their workers, their employee, to instill healthy behaviors in their employees so that these people are given time to exercise.
It's a hard and long journey for many of those living with chronic kidney disease and for their family as well. And in these trying times, there are always people who are waiting to take advantage of the situation.
At that point, 2009, 2010, there were other symptoms. I was not on dialysis yet because it was still chronic kidney disease stage. It was not yet the end stage renal disease. So I had to juggle with my dietary. I was controlling my diet. But then the uric acid will go high and I'll have gout and I'll have some other issues like the protein, urea and all that, making the entire body feel haywire a bit. All right. So she could see, even though I don't show it too much, or I always keep it to myself. My wife is already traumatized, you know, so I always keep it to myself. I don't be loud on that. But she was very disturbed. Fortunately, God grace, we got a child. In mid-2010, my son was born. So that had changed a lot of things. So both of us had, we really were out of the world, all right? Focusing on our child's growth. And Takshil, my son's name, Takshil Nair, he was the gift for us. And everything was so beautiful and we were focusing on him. That I tell you, miracle. While we go through the misery and this, my son was in the picture and it was so beautiful. So as we were going on 2010, 2011, I must tell you this. You know, when you are in this kind of situation, in a misery, there's a lot of people out there are there to take advantage. All right. And I was told that by another friend of mine that there's a product where some of the, even the dialysis patient have benefited. And after taking the product, they have got the urine flow better and all those. He recommended. So, and in fact, the people who were selling the product did mention that there were cases where it reversed, the kidney reversed. Now, at that time, I didn't know there is two aspects of kidney failure. One is chronic kidney disease and another one is acute kidney disease. Acute kidney disease, your kidney can shut off for a temporary period. Some we hear some accident cases and all, the kidney shuts off, right? And then you revive back. So that is not likely to happen for chronic kidney disease. So at that time, when someone said, you know, somebody's kidney had reversed, and well, that could be acute kidney disease, all right? So, but anything, a small hope is a big hope at that time. So I took up the product. I was continuing. Now, started from 2008 up to 2011, my creatinine was around 200. Well managed, well controlled, right? I controlled my diet very well. But after taking the product, slowly, in 2011, June, suddenly my creatinine shoots up to 550, all right? Now, I went to the doctor while they checked and they said, oh my God, your creatinine is increasing. But as for me, I'm still very young and active. So the doctors and the nephrologist told me that, Siva, if it's a person who is 60 years old or above, having creatinine at the point of 500 plus, you have to start dialysis. But as for you, we can hold on. You need not do dialysis because your track record shows you are maintaining it well. So we don't rush into that.
Did you tell your nephrologist that you were taking these supplements?
Of course, I didn't tell my nephrologist that I'm taking another product because that's definitely a no-no from their side. So as what I was telling, after getting to know about the news from my nephrologist, when I went back to the other side and the seller, the product seller, they said, Siva, I think you have to take the booster. The booster is probably a few thousand more additional, and it is equivalent to a few hundreds of the tablets getting in a small vial, all right, in a liquid form. So again, I fell for it and I got the booster. And in 2 or 3 months, my creatinine went up to 1,200. You know, before getting to know the 1,200, for a few days, I had sleepless nights, all right? I was not having good sleep. But you know, if you are having sleepless nights, usually you will be very sleepy in the daytime. But I didn't feel that. And I was already having cramps, right? Now, that's when I went and checked the doctor, and immediately they had to do a dialysis on me. All right, that was in 2012, January. So we did the dialysis, started the dialysis, right? For 6 months, I started on peritoneal dialysis. So that was the initial stage of my dialysis.
I guess our publics do not quite understand the rigorous clinical trial that each medication, each modern medication, have to undergo before they are actually being marketed, right? So most prescribed medications that we use for high blood pressure, for diabetes, have undergo intensive testing and monitoring. And we know their safety parameters, their adverse event parameters, we know that. And the doctors know exactly how to monitor. Whereas our public, I feel, tend to believe too testimonial of certain patients rather than looking at medication that have been well tested all over. So if you notice, most unregulated supplement, they receive a testimony for one or two patients that actually have used it. They may feel better on those because, you know, in any medications that you take, you can have what we call a placebo effect. You can take an empty tablet and still feel better about it. So I think this is why our public tends to like buying supplements from testimony of a couple of people. The danger for kidney disease, because we don't know what is the content. You know, you may sell a medication saying that, okay, it contains a herbs, but we don't know whether there are other components of medication, because this supplements that they take are not tested for, say, for example, analgesia. When you take analgesia, you generally feel better. Your aches and pain goes away, right? But analgesia, we know, can affect the kidney. And some medication can actually cause inflammation of the kidney without you even knowing about it. So it is, can still be dangerous to kidney patients. We've seen it intermittently, patients, you know, from CKD, one or two go to CKD 3 and 4 from taking all these medications. Unscrupulous, you know, business-minded people who promote medications where they are not supposed to.
After the break, we'll hear more on the accessibility of dialysis services and persisting taboos about organ donation in Malaysia. This is NCD Chronicles, a series that takes you beyond the diagnosis of non-communicable diseases to understand the unique struggles and needs of the individuals behind the disease. Stay tuned to Health and Living BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Health and Living with me, T. Xiao Ik. This is an episode of NCD Chronicles, a series that explores the NCD epidemic through the voices of people living with these chronic diseases. Today, we're hearing from Siva Kumar Raghavan, who was initially diagnosed with chronic kidney disease in 2008 and had been managing it relatively well for a few years. But when his kidneys deteriorated after taking a course of unregulated supplements, he had no choice but to begin peritoneal dialysis, all the while waiting for his turn, a shot really, at a kidney transplant.
My nephrologist had encouraged me to do transplant, but the transplant has to be with the same blood group pair, right? Unfortunately, all my siblings have different blood group. And my wife also have different blood group. But after 2-3 months, our nephrologist called me and said, Siva, I've got a good news. The Ministry of Health had approved the budget for HKL to proceed with the incompatible blood group transplant, right? So my wife was there. She wanted to go ahead. At that point, I was okay to continue with dialysis. But we couldn't see my young 2-year-old son going through that, you know, in the house, coming and taking me the solution and all. It was very sad to see him like that, right? We went ahead with the transplant. My wife donated her kidney. As for Ministry of Health, we were the first incompatible blood group transplant. Happened in July 2012. And instantly, the transplant was a great success. The urine outflow, the other blood results all were perfect. Mm-hmm. And it was a really good outcome. Then I was given high dosage of immunosuppressant to suppress my immune system, right? Now, when the immune system is suppressed too low, after the 2 years, there is one virus called BK virus attack my organ, the new kidney. So my creatinine was rising higher. So the doctors had to attend to it, control the, wipe out the BK virus. Then after that, they couldn't give me high dosage of immunosuppressant because if they give high dosage of immunosuppressant, my immune system will get very low and the BK virus will start coming out. So they give low dosage of immunosuppressant and eventually my immune system started to become stronger and it again attacked the new transplanted kidney. By 2016, September, my transplanted kidney also failed. And I had to go back to dialysis.
For a long time, blood incompatibility was a contraindication for an organ transplant. And you might think that ABO incompatible transplants are relatively new, considering that CIVA surgery happened in 2012. But years of data collection and observation have shown that the difference in the rate of graft failure between someone who receives a kidney from a compatible donor versus an incompatible donor is very small. In fact, ABO incompatible transplants have offered a lifeline for many patients who would otherwise spend years, if not decades, on the waiting list.
There are two types of donors. One is the living donors, where a family usually will donate one of their kidneys while they are still alive. The second option is what we call a deceased donation, where you basically are put into a waiting list and waiting for a kidney from a brain dead donor or a person who have been declared cardiac death, right? And the waiting list for a deceased donor in Malaysia is extremely long because we don't have that much donor. If you have a living donor, then of course we can evaluate in a transplant center to see the suitability before we can actually proceed. ABO incompatible kidney transplant is when you receive a kidney from a donor who does not have the compatible blood group. There are four types of blood group: O, A, B, and AB. Blood group O is a universal donor, whereas blood group AB is universal recipient. So they can receive kidneys from any blood group. And when we talk about ABO incompatible kidney transplant, the donor may be A and the recipient may be O, or the recipient may be B. Why do we resort to ABO incompatible transplant? Is because this is one way to increase transplant number. As many of our patients, they only have one potential donor instead of many potential donors. So if a person comes with three potential donors, of course, we will encourage those patients with the same blood group to come forward. But if they don't, then we may consider to take these incompatible donors as the patient's donor. And basically, the benefit of ABO incompatible transplant, the success rate is still almost as good as ABO compatible transplant. So it actually improved the patient's quality of life and it improved the patient's survival. However, it does carry a small increased risk in rejection and increased risk of infection. Basically, they have increased risk of early rejection, where the kidney is actually being rejected within the transplant or within a couple of days after the transplant. That is the main cause of graft failure. And if you look at the success or the rate of graft failure with ABO, comparing ABO compatible versus incompatible transplant, the rate of graft failure is only marginally increased with ABO incompatible transplant at 1 year graft survival of 96% with ABO incompatible transplant, whereas you get 98% with ABO compatible transplant. So all in all, the success rate is actually very good for ABO incompatible transplant. Mm. The main reason for allograft failure is actually a type of rejection where we call antibody-mediated rejection. Right, antibody-mediated rejection is basically the recipient producing antibody that attacking the donor kidneys. And this is usually because there are periods of where the patient is not taking their immunosuppression properly. When they don't take their immunosuppression properly, the body will produce antibody against the donor kidneys. And over time, the antibodies will attack the kidney slowly and cause allograft failure or kidney failure.
For patients with end-stage renal disease, receiving a kidney transplant is the ideal solution. A transplant usually means a longer life, better quality of life, without needing regular dialysis. Unfortunately, the reality is many Malaysians with end-stage renal disease are relying on dialysis, and Dr. Rosnawati says that this is taking a significant toll on our healthcare system.
CKD and end-stage renal disease burden is definitely on the rise. Based on a publication by Saminathan et al. Published in 2020, the prevalence of CKD currently is about 15%, which is roughly about 1 in 8 people are actually suffered from chronic kidney disease. In terms of incidence and prevalence of end-stage renal disease, this is also definitely increasing. The statistic from Malaysian Dialysis and Transplant Registry at 31st December of 2016, the number of treated end-stage renal disease was actually more than 40,000 patients, and the number continued to grow. The annual growth of end-stage renal disease in Malaysia is estimated to increase at a rate of 4.5% per year, and it is projected that by December 2040, we are expected to see about 100,000 patients treated for end-stage renal disease. So I think it is affecting our healthcare system in a big way. There was a publication by Dr. Herman Ismail et al. From the Ministry of Health. He indicated that the total annual expenditure of end-stage renal disease by the public sector has grown 94% within a span of 7 years, which was from Malaysian ringgit 572 million in 2010 to Malaysian ringgit 1.12 billion in 2016. And the total end-stage renal disease expenditure in 2010 constituted about 2.95% of the public sector total health expenditure, whereas in 2016, the proportion has increased to 4.2%. So significant increase in terms of money that is actually being spent to treat end-stage renal disease patients. Of this, only 6% were actually spent on renal transplantation, whereas the remaining 94% was actually spent on dialysis.
Malaysia's kidney transplant rate is among the lowest globally, at 3 per million population. In comparison, Spain, which has one of the highest kidney transplant rates globally, has upwards of 50 transplants per million population in recent years. And these are numbers that include living and deceased donors. Part of the reason behind our dismal transplant rate is plain and simple. It's still taboo.
I must tell you this story. You know, this is really, really very ironic. In 2008, one of my Rotarian, she is a key person for transplant, Dr. Pramila. She shared about organ donation. Now, I and another person, there's only two of us in the club, pledged our organ at that time. All right? So I went back home. I told my wife, you know what? this is the card I've pledged for my organ. If anything happens to me, please be reminded that I'm organ pledger. Do you know what happened? She started crying. She broke down and she cried and said, what are you talking about this? What? Why are you going into that and whatsoever? Why are you? I said, what happened? Why are you breaking down and all? No, how can you talk like that? He said, I'm not saying I'm going to die tomorrow. By all means, we want to live as long as we want. Right? In case anything happened, it's only right that I feel that my organs can be donated. Now, what's wrong in that? Now, the irony is, after 4 or 5 years, she became a donor. So, it's so funny, right? That's the thing. I mean, are we emotionally or even mentally prepared to hear one of our family members says that I'm going to be an organ pledger? Organ pledger is not an organ donor. Pledging his organ if anything happens. And we pray that nothing happens to you. But that, even that, is taboo. We can't hear that.
I think the most important thing is to improve on public awareness on the importance of organ donation. And I think public awareness in Malaysia is still lacking. There are myths to say that when the patient's donating their kidneys or organs, there are body mutilation involved during the organ procurement, which isn't true because the potential donor are basically treated with respect, just like how we remove organ from a living person, right? And the body is closed properly, so on and so forth. There are some people believe the need to have a complete body after one dies, which again isn't true because our fatwa in Malaysia, among all the religions, actually labeled organ donation as harus, meaning you can actually donating your organs. The other reason I feel is in the healthcare facility itself, where the detection of brain dead patients are still low. This requires healthcare workers to constantly be very vigilant to identify brain dead patients to be considered as organ donors. Because if you don't diagnose brain death, you will never ask the family about the possibility of being an organ donor. So this is something healthcare workers need to be fully aware and being very active in donor detection.
Ideally, if you ask me, our country needs a national transplant institute. There is a career development for the transplant specialists. Now, the transplant only happens when the transplant happens, the nephrologist and urologist come together. After that, there is no transplant department or transplant anything there. All right? So, if we have a transplant institute, all of these people will be under one roof. Right? There are also that question has been raised that, Siva, do you know that we don't have enough donors? Now, if you can go on and talking about this, it's like a chicken and egg phenomena. Which one comes first? All right, we need the donor or the transplant institute?
When Siva's transplant failed, it was a blow to him and the people around him. But he chose to focus on the positives and how being on dialysis isn't as bad as some people make it out to be.
Now, when the transplant failed, even the nephrology, my doctors, the whole community were like seeing me as though it's the end of life. I mean, they're all very sad that the transplanted kidney had failed. Of course, they were having very high hopes, being the first ABOI, the different blood group transplant and all. So everyone were very sad and say, sorry, Siva, you know. So it's like I was thinking, oh my God, this is end of the world or what for me, right? Was it so bad? I mean, going into dialysis. So when I went into dialysis, I realized something else. I realized that there are patients who are living a good life, a quality life, for being a dialysis patient for 20 over years, 25 years. Another abang there doing for 22 years. No, so I was also very impressed. So that has was giving me some hopes. the technology of dialysis 30 years ago and now, it's very advanced. All right? So it's not that bad. This time, I opted for hemodialysis because peritoneal dialysis, which I took before the transplant, I have to do 4 times in a day. So it restricted my movement here and there. So this time I take hemodialysis because hemodialysis is like every alternate day in a week you do 3 times. And the other 1.5 day you are free to move anywhere. I can even do elsewhere, right? I've done in India. I did it in Penang, Ipoh. The challenges are endless. When the kidney is not functioning, the entire body will go haywire. The initial stage before the dialysis and all, my uric acid was going haywire, so I even had gout. But after the dialysis, even the peritoneal dialysis, that was under control. But you see, when I if you see food, you would see, you know, the vegetable or the rice or noodle or whatsoever. But I see how much protein, how much potassium, how much phosphate on my plate, right? Because it makes a lot of difference, right? So if I overtake any of those, it can be very bad for me. I mean, I have to look at the positive side, right? I started asking these other patients who are living a good life and managing their dialysis well. So their secret is, number one, managing their dietary and also being active, all right? They do lots of walks and keeping them active. Now, that's when I started doing my walks. Right, I started doing a 10 minutes walk, 20 minutes, and then I started climbing small hills in my place where I live in Malawati. And I love to take up challenges. I took up the challenge of me going up some mountains. A group of friends, they did the 7 highest peaks in peninsula. Right, so I did one of it, the Ulu Sepat, the G7. So that was really challenging because I have to skip dialysis for 3 days. All right, so of course, the maximum I skip is 2 days, usually Saturday and Sunday. But this time is Saturday, Sunday and Monday. So I had to do the first dialysis Friday and the next one Tuesday. Now, I'm a person, you throw me in a jungle, I try to live within the means. So that's what's happening right now. So I'm in the situation where I have to do dialysis 3 times a week, right? Of course, the ideal solution will be a transplant. But as for now, I don't see any light at the end of the tunnel in terms of transplant here. So I have to live with it. I want to give hope to my kids, for my family. Their father is alive and they can expect to do with their father whatever that any other fathers can do. So I never give them the picture that your father is sickly and he cannot do. As much as possible, I give them that experience, what they have to go through in their childhood, right? So being a dialysis patient, I know the time is crucial. Right, because a lot of people ask me, oh my God, 3 days in a week, you have to sit down there for 4 hours, right? Now, I would say at least that's great. If not, you would see my picture hanging on the wall, right? So at least I have a solution, right? At least after doing, you know, actually it's not only 4 hours. For me to drive there and prepare myself, after completing the 4 hours waiting, plus minus, it will be 6 hours actually. So 6 hours times 3, all right? I have to set aside for dialysis every week. How would I say? Is it a challenge or is a blessing in disguise? No, I would say it's a blessing in disguise.
Maintaining a healthy lifestyle while on dialysis is one thing, but are all patients who need dialysis able to access it?
The one thing is that dialysis is expensive. Right? Those patients who get to the government system, the Ministry of Health dialysis unit, they tend to pay a very minimum amount, you know, like 20 ringgit per dialysis, where the cost of dialysis is actually roughly about 150 to 200 ringgit per dialysis session outside. So the funding models for dialysis is not consistent across the board. So it's really different whether you get funding from a social organization like SOXO, if you get it from a religious organization like Zakat and Baitul Mal, the funding model is not consistent, which makes access to care also not consistent. Because for you to best manage this patient, it's not just by giving them dialysis per se. There are many aspects of management of end-stage renal disease patient needs to be focused on, such as anemia management, management of bone disease, management of nutritional status, control of infection, vascular access monitoring, and ensuring dialysis adequacy. So the funding for the management of comorbidities in dialysis patients are not consistent across the board.
Kidney damage in chronic kidney disease patients cannot be reversed. But with early detection and the right management, the progression of the disease can be slowed down. That's why Dr. Rosnawati highlights the importance of getting people screened.
I think information is power, right? So a lot of information, and education to all our patients, regardless whether they are having CKD and whether they have developed end-stage renal disease. And I think Ministry of Health have done a lot of initiative together with professional societies such as Malaysian Society of Nephrology, Malaysian Society of Transplantation, together with non-governmental organizations such as National Kidney Foundation. They develop websites such as My Buah Pinggang, where you can get various information there, as well as Q&A area where you can actually ask questions directly to a nephrologist that managing the website. And they also have developed various mobile applications to assist patients to track their CKD progress, to enable them to get information on dietary resources, so on and so forth. I think information is very good and needs to be continued on. You know, when we talk about end-stage renal disease, we really talk about non-communicable disease. I heard a speech by our YBKJ. He mentioned about going for early screening and early detection. And he's targeting to reduce this about 1 million cases a year by asking patients to go through screening at our free screening at our clinic kesihatan. If we can actually screen 1 million patients a year for diseases like hypertension, diseases like hyperlipidemia, diseases like diabetes, we can actually tackle this problem at early stage and reduce the incidence. Not only end-stage kidney disease, we can also reducing the incidence of cardiovascular disease, a stroke, so on and so forth.
As for Siva, he's not letting his health issues define nor stop him. In spite of all the curveballs that life has thrown at him, Siva continues to advocate for more people to pledge to donate their organs and to talk to their family members about it. He's determined to make the most of his time, going on exciting adventures and creating new memories with his family. And what better way to do that than to summit Mount Kinabalu?
So I got these friends of mine in Rotary Club of Malawati said, okay, we have to do something on that 50th birthday. We shouldn't just turn 50 just like that. It has to be really memorable. I've done Kinabalu back when I was 26 years old. Now, after 26 years, I had to do it again. But the 2020 didn't go through because of pandemic. But we were waiting for everything to go back to normal and when the borders are open. So in 2021, it was end 2021, it was declared. So we plan to go up Kinabalu in June 2022. I was the organizing chairman. So the day that I chose for the Kinabalu climb was 23rd June 2022 because that's my son's birthday, right? And he just turned 12 and I took him along with me. I want it to be a memorable birthday for him. You know, I don't know how long I'll be alive. So at least with me around, there is something really memorable for him. You know, and we want to do some fundraising and create awareness. So I got a few others who to champion this. A few others, the two transplant recipients, that is Manwer Victor and Hanafi Saleh, followed us, right? And even Manwer and Hanafi, who showed real positive mental attitude, they had their own challenges. All right. It's not that they are transplanted and, you know, it's easy piece of cake for them. So I had to do dialysis one day earlier. That evening before we climb, I did it in Ranau. So the next early morning, we climb. And then after finishing, coming back to KK, and I did the next dialysis in Hospital Likas. All of us reached the peak. All right. It was a really very successful. And with us, all together, 26 of us climb, all right? It was not an easy task for all of them. It's not for me and the other transplant recipients only, because the rest also had their own challenges, all right, due to their age factor and all. So they were saying that if this fella can do it, why not us, you know? And all of them took up the challenge and we did it. It was a great, great experience.
This has been NCD Chronicles, a series featuring the experiences and challenges of people with non-communicable diseases. If you missed any part of the show or previous episodes, you can search for it on bfm.my or on our BFM app. You've been listening to Health and Living on BFM 89.9.
You have been listening to a podcast from BFM 89.9, the business station. For more stories of the same kind, download the BFM app.